This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We invest in the symphony. We'll build an opera house, or we'll build a community stage or something like that. Why is building a ballpark any different? And what I would say to that, it isn't different except for one thing. Again, they don't need a subsidy.
Did you know that almost all NFL teams are profitable before a single ticket is sold? And did you know that for most of these teams, it's public dollars that have made this level of profitability possible? A few weeks ago on Sea Change Radio, we discussed some of the environmental advances being championed in the sports industry. Today, we speak with Patrick Ruby, a writer and podcaster for Sports on Earth. He offers a complimentary, if contrasting, perspective to our earlier discussion by highlighting what he terms sports welfare. We talk about how common government subsidies are in the sports industry and the opportunity cost felt by environmental causes when public coffers are drained in order to bankroll some of the wealthiest enterprises in America. So I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Patrick Ruby. He's a sports writer and journalist for Sports on Earth, as well as the host of the podcast Ruby Tuesday. Patrick, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be here.
So Patrick, a few weeks ago we had a guest on, Alan Hershkowitz of the NRDC, who spoke about sustainability efforts in the American sports industry. But we didn't get to dive much into the negative impact that sports has on our society. You're a sports writer and obviously love sports as much as anyone, but you're also a clear-eyed journalist who's able to view things more holistically than most of us. I'd imagine that you think that there's more than a few downsides to these games that we love, right?
Sure there are. Look, people like to think of sports as sort of almost existing within the sports page. But, we like to sort of have sports as our escape, as it somehow exists. Once you're between those lines, the rest of the world, it goes away. But the truth is, sports is a part of life, just like everything else is a part of life. And almost every ill that you can find, every social ill, every political ill, every economic ill that exists outside of sports, exists inside of sports. Sports and the rest of the world are really one and the same. That is something I constantly sort of write about as a theme, one way or another. In terms of specific things, specific problems, I think one of the best places you can start is just looking at the economics of sports. How does it actually work? Where does money actually come from?
And it's really changed quite a bit since I was growing up in the 70s. You didn't necessarily have to be the richest of the rich to own a sports franchise, but the calculus has really changed, hasn't it?
Well, you've always had to be pretty rich, because here's the thing. This is sort of one of the original economic, I would say, sins of American sport, is that all these leagues have like various degrees of antitrust protection, whether it's explicit or implicit. And because of that, ownership, to get to your first question there, it's kind of like an exclusive club. The franchises become very valuable because someone who's rich can't just start one. You have to buy your way in, and all the other club owners have to allow that, and they keep the supply of teams low. If you look at other countries, there's no reason that New York City doesn't have 5 NBA teams and 4 NFL teams and 6 baseball teams. Due to its, in terms of its population, it could probably support numbers like that. I might be a little bit high, but it could support more than it has. But it doesn't, because that would dilute up the supply, dilute the demand, and it would dilute the value of the franchise that currently exists. The New York Yankees would be much less valuable if it weren't just the New York Mets in town. So, that's kind of, and it's not just a matter of franchise values that sort of come out of that. There's all sorts of problems with sports that come out of this, quasi-monopoly that we allow them to have.
So that was one of the things that I brought up with Alan Hershkowitz, was he had mentioned what great efforts Major League Baseball has been making in its stadia, and that Bud Selig has really been quite admirable when it comes to this. And Dr. Hershkowitz works for the NRDC, and he's an environmentalist. And I mentioned, what if the executive director of the NRDC made $22 million last year? And I misstated, actually. I thought Roger Goodell made $30 million last year, but it was the year before. This year, he made $44 million. And the NFL has a 501c6 designation with Congress, and Major League Baseball has a 501c3. And these are basically taxpayer-funded leagues in many ways, because we look the other way when it comes to collecting taxes on the stadia and the like, right?
Yeah, that's kind of the big thing in terms of one of the big, depending on how you look at it, it's a problem or it's not. I kind of see it as a problem, which is we have a massive public subsidy for sport in this country. So even if you're talking about a major league ballpark or an NFL stadium that is doing some things to conserve energy or incorporate or include environmental features into the stadium or the stadium design, if it's something that's being built, there's nothing bad about that. I think that is good. I think that is admirable. Energy efficiency is obviously a really big deal. It's one of those things that isn't sexy, but can make a big difference in terms of, global warming. I'm sorry, climate change, whatever you want to call it, in terms of our carbon emissions, in terms of our energy use, in terms of, things being sustainable and not degrading the environment further. Just the simple thing of just making things more efficient really does matter. So, stadiums do tend to draw a lot of power. If there's ways to, for instance, bring that power usage down, good for all of us. I would applaud any sports league, any sports owner, any sports team that's doing that.
And when you see a stadium that gets, let's say a baseball stadium might get 2 or 3 million people going through its gates every year, that sets an example for people, hopefully.
Hopefully. I'm not sure how much of an example it sets. I don't know if those same people are going to go home and buy, the energy efficient light bulbs. I'm not sure. I guess we kind of have to do that now. But
or just even seeing solar panels up on MetLife Stadium or wherever.
Yeah, no, I think that's good. I think it's very good whether, like I said, whether it's an example being set or actually cutting down energy use, even better. Actions sort of speak louder than words. But the flip side to this, in terms of your earlier question, is, like I said, there's this huge subsidy. So most of these stadiums are funded partially or almost wholly by taxpayers. And it isn't just the actual construction costs of the stadium, which are funded by these municipal bonds, that in turn, so the local municipality or state is paying for it. And in turn, we're all paying for it around the country because there's a tax exemption on these same types of bonds. Congress makes them exempt because they want to encourage cities and towns and counties and schools, and states to build schools, to build roads, to build sewage, to build, big municipal projects. But somehow stadiums fall into this as well. So we are all paying for stadiums at some level. And also in terms of the public subsidy is all the stuff that goes around building these stadiums. So roads, parking, infrastructures need to be put into place, parking garages. But what's bad is that these are, how do I say it? I'll put it simply. These are businesses that don't need the money. Like, sports is very profitable. Like, you talked about how it's changed over the last 30 years. It's become incredibly more popular and more profitable. The amount of money they're making has way outpaced inflation. Basically, they don't need the help. The NFL does not need an auto industry bailout. They are doing just fine without taxpayer intervention. So is baseball. So is the NBA. And I think, to me, that's what makes it offensive. That's what makes it, it's bad enough that we're supporting private business with public dollars, that we're essentially doing the Wall Street business model where the public's assuming the risk and the private company is getting all the profit. But the worst part about it is that they don't need the money. They are no danger of collapsing. They don't need a bailout. And yet we've been giving these sports leagues and teams a bailout for 50 plus years now. some people will make an argument, and I think this is a somewhat fair argument, that, well, look, sports are like ballet or the symphony. It's sort of like a generalized, you know, aesthetic public good, something that the public enjoys. We invest in the symphony. We, you know, we'll build an opera house, or we'll build a community stage or something like that. Why is building a ballpark any different? And what I would say to that, you know, it isn't different except for one thing. Again, they don't need the subsidy.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, speaking to journalist Patrick Ruby. So sports are obviously, let's just assume that they're a social good, for argument's sake, and oil and gas companies are not, just making things oversimplified. But with that in mind, they're not that dissimilar in that they both get taxpayer money and they don't really need it. And yes, I'm sure the environmental sports movement has played an important role in greening stadia and making sure that there are great efforts being made in recycling and other areas and power use in these stadiums. But I'm sure Shell Oil is doing some great stuff with their recycling in their headquarters, let's say, for example, just for argument's sake. But they're not that dissimilar in that we're all kind of subsidizing these corporations that don't really need it. And if that money could be put into whatever we want, whether it be environmental efforts or education, roads, et cetera, right?
It could. I mean, that, and that's where, you know, with this issue, and I think, you know, your comparison to energy industry subsidies is very apt. They're, again, two industries that are doing not only just fine, they're doing more than fine. They're making money hand over fist. So, I mean, in terms of, you know, businesses that are doing well, those are two industries that are doing very well. They're providing stuff that we want to pay for as a society through the private sector. That's great. I have no problem with that. But you're right. Every dollar that we then subsidize them with, every dollar we needlessly throw at them, that's a dollar we could be, you know, either, look, it's a dollar you could be spending on some sort of, you know, sustainable energy project or some sort of recycling project or painting roofs white.
There's an opportunity cost.
Yeah, there's an opportunity cost there. Alternately, that's for, you know, that's for my liberal friends. For my conservative friends, that's a dollar you could not be paying in taxes. If this is one of those few issues, it's, and I think oil subsidies are the same as sports subsidies. I really feel like the Tea Party and like the most liberal people you can think of, you know, Occupy Wall Street, ought to be able to get together, shake hands, and be like, well, this is one thing we both can oppose. Like, no, none of us are cool with throwing this money away. Like, maybe we have different ideas what to do with it instead, but we all can agree we don't need to give money to businesses that don't need money.
So the ownership has transformed with the way that we finance stadiums, as well as the TV rights deals. Like one of the reasons why the Yankees, that I think George Steinbrenner bought for under $20 million back in the 70s, is now, you know, maybe worth $2 billion, is very much tied to the YES Network and TV rights. But these owners are now in the business of being sports owners. I think of the DiBartolo family, which is outlined in Greg Easterbrook's excellent book on the business side of football called The King of Sports. And he talks about how Eddie DiBartolo Sr. was an Ohio tycoon or an entrepreneur who started a chain malls, and he was in the retail business. And then he bought the 49ers. The 49ers are now owned by the second generation of that family, which doesn't really need to do anything because they can hold communities hostage and get their stadium deals and move it for ridiculous amounts of money, and that's what just happened here in San Francisco, for example. The Niners are moving from Candlestick Park down to San Jose, and the York family slash DeBartolo family is making much more than they ever could in malls. Now, beyond the threat of moving a team to another city, Patrick, can you address the promise that sports leagues and team owners dangle over communities in terms of these often illusory revenues, this stream of revenue that's supposed to come from hosting an All-Star game or a Super Bowl? These aren't actually really good investments, are they?
Right. This is always the argument. The argument is always, you know, build this stadium and you're going to revitalize your downtown. It's going to bring X amount of dollars here. And then you're going to be able to host the Super Bowl, and that's going to bring X amount of dollars.
I can understand the calculations a little bit when it comes to putting a Super Bowl in, like, Jacksonville, but in New York City...
Even you're talking about New York City or Jacksonville, here's the thing about those calculations. These studies are always done by, like, pay-for economists that are working for the teams and for the leagues. They don't hold up. They're kind of like, you know, old tobacco studies that cigarettes don't cause cancer, the tobacco industry funded studies, or energy industry funded studies that say, oh yeah, you know, coal, like carbon emissions, not a problem. You know, fracking is causing no pollution whatsoever. They're not credible. These studies that always say, oh, we're going to make, you know, $200 million hosting the Super Bowl, it's always much, much, much lower.
You don't have to be an economist to figure out that when you want to book a hotel room in New York, it's usually competitive because there's some kind of convention there. There are people who go to New York or New Orleans or San Francisco. These are like big destination cities. So to somehow calculate that if we have an extra event there, it's going to lead to X amount of money for a city, it seems like a stretch by anyone's calculation.
Right. It is even more absurd when you're talking about tourist destinations.
So I had mentioned to Dr. Hershkowitz how Tom Benson gets a $7 million a year inducement payment from the state of Louisiana.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that payment is a microcosm of how almost all of the stadium stuff really works. That gets back to the antitrust stuff I was talking about.
Yeah, this one's just more bald-faced, right?
Yeah, this is just the pure distillation of it. But it's extortion. It's the exact same thing. It's give me money or I'll take my business elsewhere to someone who will give me money. And again, that's fair, except in most businesses, you know, if Target says, hey, we're going to move out of town if you don't build us a new Target instead of us building it, you know, Walmart will just swoop in and build one and take the business that's available in that town. But in sports, they limit the number of teams. So they have the upper hand. They can play cities against each other. And again, they can also do that because these cities, again, when they're agreeing to build these stadiums, they also stupidly don't make the team stay there. They never lock the team into any kind of, well, you have to stay here for X number of years. Even worse, I think here's something that actually might make a little more sense. If a city said, okay, we'll build you a stadium, and in exchange, you're going to give us some equity in the team. Your franchise value is going to go up big time when you have this new stadium, because that's what happens. Because, again, franchise values go up, again, largely because there are not an infinite supply of teams. In fact, it's very hard to add a new team. So, you know, scarcity dictates value. So if the cities were to say, sure, okay, we'll give you $500 million for your stadium, but we want, you know, X amount of equity in return. Or when you sell your team, we want X amount of the profit from that. At least that would be a better deal. I'm not saying you should do it, but at least it'd be an investment that would actually have a return instead of like a complete loss for the city.
But these cities don't have leverage, apparently.
That's the problem.
Like, so Seattle said, you know, we don't want, and I know a lot of the activists up in the Seattle area who worked against financing the redo of Key Arena or wherever the Supersonics were playing. And then that guy from Oklahoma swoops in and says, let's go to Oklahoma City. And he gets the deal he wants from a much, much smaller city, but he's doing well. The place is full, and I'm sure he got an incredible deal. I don't know the details of it. And similarly here in another progressive city like San Francisco, they made it work with the Giants, where it was a very different calculation. It wasn't taxpayer funded.
No, you're right. I mean, look, there's always, they have leverage because they can't actually leave. But the cities are, I would say, the weird thing is the cities actually have more leverage now than they probably did in the past, because there's not that many cities left that can afford to or want to build or can really support a major league team in all the big sports. Soccer is different, but in basketball, there's probably a handful. But football, there's really at this point, Los Angeles. I mean, the reason there's no NFL team in Los Angeles is simple. They want to keep leveraging Los Angeles to get new stadiums built everywhere else. It was the same thing that happened here. I live in D.C. The second that Major League Baseball basically had new ballparks built everywhere else, D.C. got a team. D.C. was never going to get a team until almost every other city was exhausted. And then we agreed to build a ballpark here as well. But that's kind of how it works. You know, you always want to stall. I mean, Seattle is very good for the NBA right now. What has Seattle done? Seattle has gotten a sweet deal in Oklahoma City, and it also has gotten a sweet deal in Sacramento for a new stadium, because Seattle's a stalking horse.
Seattle's the LA of the NBA.
Yeah, Seattle's the LA of the NBA. So it's probably in the best interest of, this sounds weird because Seattle's a big television market and a big market, and you would think the NBA would want a team there. And I'm sure at some level they very much would. And I'm sure all those owners would love a sweet cut of a, you know, expansion fee if there's a new team. But it's also sort of in their medium term interest to not have a new team there very fast, because you can keep leveraging it like you did in Sacramento.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, speaking to journalist Patrick Ruby. As you were talking about, we were talking about whether or not the community is benefiting from this. As these stadia deals get more expensive and luxury boxes become kind of the currency that goes into any kind of calculus, how many luxury boxes are you going to give me? Because that's where all the real revenue is for an owner. These luxury boxes and the premium seats become way too expensive for an average family of four to go to a few games a year. It's a big luxury. And so it becomes, for example, in Yankee Stadium, most of those really high-priced seats right behind home plate are from bankers who live in Greenwich, or there's not a lot of people who are like walking to the stadium from Bronx.
The money you get out of a stadium isn't so much attendance as it is that targeted corporate attendance, right? The most expensive seats, the boxes. But the biggest money in sports now is the TV money. It isn't the actual money you're getting at the turnstile. That's even true for baseball, which has the most home games. But the TV money is astronomical. And that, in a way, is also sort of quasi-subsidized by the public. Now, it's not subsidized by tax money. We're not, Congress isn't, you know, appropriating money to ESPN. It doesn't work that way. But the way it works is via cable and satellite television. You know, you have your cable bill, let's say, and it's $80 a month or something like that. $5 a month of that is for ESPN. It's literally for ESPN. Now, 60 to 70% of the audience, of not the audience, of subscribers to cable and satellite TV, so it's 100 million households in the country, essentially, pay TV. You know, the vast majority of them not only don't watch ESPN, they never watch ESPN. But they're still forced to pay that $5 a month. Everyone pays it.
So Alan Hershkowitz had talked about how one of the things that hamstrings stadia and teams from doing the kind of waste management that they want is that the community doesn't have it in place. For example, Houston, I think, only recycles around 10 or 15% of their waste stream, while San Jose does around 80 to 85%. So their infrastructure is already in place. But with the money that these teams are receiving from the public, couldn't they kind of be leaders in this realm instead of followers when it comes to taking care of waste and composting and recycling, which could be a tremendous boon to local communities?
I don't see why not. I mean, the relative cost is probably low compared to what they're taking in.
We've already been talking about the tremendous amount of money that is going to not only the stadium, but the owners. Couldn't there be little riders that say, hey, if we can upgrade our system, we'll keep your team. But there could be good environmental outcomes from the stadium deal rather than the owners dependent on pre-existing infrastructure in order to do the right thing, quote unquote, do the right thing with the environment.
I mean, no, I think you could get, like I said, you can go back to where we started. There's probably different types of retrofitting that can be done to stadiums and to the infrastructure around the stadium to make them more environmentally friendly or helpful. But at some point, I mean, I'm not sure. You're probably playing small ball, to use a sports metaphor there. You're probably at the most getting base hits. I don't know if you can really get a home run out of that.
Well, to be honest, after talking to Dr. Hershkowitz, it felt like a lot of this was small ball, and that like getting an antibiotic-free hot dog in a stadium is not comparable to a $900 million bond giveaway to a billionaire family to move their team.
That's what I'm saying. It completely isn't. I mean, when I think I'm not an expert, I haven't gone down to the EPA and asked someone to analyze the environmental impact of one given stadium. But if I'm just, you know, spitballing out of my head here, I would assume that the two biggest factors in terms of the environment, that environmental impact in a stadium, my guess would be power usage. And if you're talking about an NFL stadium that's out in the suburbs somewhere, all the driving that happens to and from.
Transportation costs, right?
Transportation. So you've got all these people hopping in their cars and driving to the stadium and, you know, putting CO2 in the air. And same with the power usage, same thing. That's the big thing that we're all worrying about. You know, that's the big threat to like our future on this planet. And so is that somewhere where you can make a difference? I don't know. I mean, hopefully you can have stadiums that are built with public transportation in mind. Some are, some aren't. Depends on the location. Depends on the people there, if they like using that or not. Can you add that? Sometimes it's very expensive, and it's, again, people often choose not to use it depending on where you are in the country. I don't know what else they can really do. I mean, certainly they can use more solar power potentially, or they can use renewables, or they can do more recycling. I mean, all those things are good, but you're not going to spend $900 million of public money on a stadium and get $900 million of environmental goodness in return. There's no chance. If you want that, you got to spend $900 million on a giant wind farm.
He's a sports writer for Sports on Earth. People can also check out his podcast, Ruby Tuesday. That's H-R-U-B-Y Tuesday. Patrick Ruby. Patrick, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Grant Green, Apocalyptica, and Neil Young.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidioedu.org. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.